We're in a series in the book of Philippians, and there's another pastor friend of mine in town. His name is Tyler Brown. He is a pastor at New Harvest Church. They're on like I-5 and Portland Road. And we've basically been kind of like tag teaming the research and the outline and kind of the structure for this Philippians series, sharing notes and things like that. And I taught at their church today this passage that I'm about to teach for you. And then next week, he's going to teach for his church and then come here and teach for us the next passage in Philippians. So I'm telling you this because I started with an introduction that bombed more than I've ever had any type of attempt at humor bomb. Like, if you were there, you would be like, oh, Michael. Like, you would have prayed for me on the spot that I might preach again ever. And so there's a lot on the line here. I need this to not bomb for my people. And I'm like 90% sure that it won't. But I was pretty sure that some people there would resonate with it, and not really. So I need someone to fill in these blanks, to know what this quote is and what movie it's from. We've got no... Maddie? Yeah. It's a movie quote. Maybe I'll just give you the context. A comedy from the 90s. Or you don't need to be embarrassed to say it if you know it. We've got no food. We've got no jobs. Oh, man. Pets' heads are falling off. You guys have really, really let me down. The bummer is, I'll just let you guys in on a little secret. Introductions are difficult. And I didn't even feel like this one tied in that well with what I need to share. So it's like, I need something to kind of wade into the topic. And yeah, this wasn't it. Number one, if you haven't seen Dumb and Dumber, am I allowed to recommend that you go see that movie? I don't know. Probably. That moment, he's just like, life is collapsing on them. And he's like, says, we've got no food. The quote that you guys don't know, we got no food, we got no jobs, our pets' heads are falling off. Everything is just falling apart in that moment. Here's the really weak tie-in. Do you ever feel like that too? It would have been better if you guys knew the movie quote. Yeah. Everything is off in the world. Have you had moments where you're like, personally, yeah, this is like rough right now. And whether it's some type of community that you're involved in, this is off. And the world at large is just nuts right now. Maybe not even just in the obvious ways when you like look at headlines or scroll social media, read about another crisis. I'm talking about how the everyday experience of life feels relationally bent and distorted and messy. Have you had the experience where having substantive conversation, like conversation about real things that really matter, feels risky? Like, this could go south because I don't know what this person thinks and it could go poorly. People, maybe not you, but people can be quick to anger. We easily assume the worst, and when things go south, we're pretty quick to withdraw and retreat. Like, well, guess we're not friends anymore. Things feel fragile and volatile. And you can see this maybe most obviously when things like politics and culture come up. There's this Pew study from a few years ago said that 65% of Americans always or often feel exhausted when they think about politics, and then 55% feel often angry when they think about politics. And those stats, you're not like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I guess some people are probably angry and or tired out there. That reality has invaded your life and my life. It's invaded our homes maybe, our dinner tables, our text threads, friend groups, communities, even churches. But that's only one part of the equation. Politics and the fragility of the things that we talk about isn't the whole story. It's a symptom of something else. There was a CDC report in 2024 that said 1 in 3 adults say they feel lonely. 1 in 4 say they don't have the social and emotional support that they need. So there's a lot of people. In spite of the vast number of ways that we could be connected to one another, it feels endless the ways we could be talking and connecting. Many people feel deeply alone. So at the same time, we are desperate for meaningful relationship and friendship with one another. And we also live in and maybe contribute to an environment where cultivating those relationships and maintaining them is harder than ever because we're maybe a little bit heated and angry already and definitely pretty tired. And it can be tempting, I don't know about you, as a Jesus follower, to look out at the world and all the things that are wrong with it, the things that we think are broken, and feel maybe a little bit of moral outrage. We see the things that are broken, sinful, and wrong, and we can begin to either feel like or sound like an angry, judgmental person shaking our fists at the world. But what if we looked with some compassion? Because I think we might see that the world isn't just like doing bad things, but it is bent and warped in a way that is tragic, is sad, because humans are not flourishing very well right now. And we're not immune in the church. Things are difficult for us too. And so our passage in Philippians, Paul describes the world in language that feels to me really relevant to our cultural moment. And he also shows us what it looks like for followers of Jesus to live differently in the middle of it. Not with superiority, not with panic at how bad things are, not with outrage, but with a quiet and steady humility that shines and stands out in the world. So as we dive into the text, there's this question to think about. In what particular way should our lives as Jesus followers look different in a world that feels warped and crooked and bent out of shape? So we're going to turn to Philippians chapter 2, and we're going to cover a big chunk, verse 14 through 30. So I'm going to start with just verses 14 through part of 16. Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky, as you hold firmly to the word of life. Those verses right there is like, it's the main part and the main point of this whole passage that we're about to look at. Usually the passage kind of like builds up to the main deal, but we just get it right off the bat right here. And so we will spend the majority of our time talking about those few verses and why they matter for our lives. So with that in mind, I'm gonna like summarize them really quickly, cover the rest of the text, and then come back and kind of camp out on those verses for a little while. Paul's encouragement here in what we just read, verses 14 through 16, is to conduct our life together as a church in such a way that we are not marked by grumbling, complaining, arguing, that we don't fall into a pattern of contentiousness or fighting with one another. He says, as we do this, we become pure and blameless. The idea is not that we become sinless, but rather that our behavior generally matches the character of Jesus. He's not describing moral perfection. He's talking about integrity. So if Jesus, as we've learned in chapter 2, particularly over the last few weeks, if Jesus lived a life of humble service, putting others before himself, even until the point of dying on a cross for us, if he does that, but then the church lives selfish lives where we put ourselves first and we're constantly having these terrible attitudes where it's me first and we're fighting and argumentative and complaining, that causes the gospel to lose credibility before a world that's like watching how we live. The world is contentious. God's people, like Jesus, should shine like stars with the way that we treat one another. And in so doing, the world should see a difference in how we live, and it should hopefully draw people to Jesus. Those verses that we just read in verse 16, they end with Paul acknowledging God's people will shine like stars as we hold fast to the word of life. Some translations say hold out or hold up the word of life. And this is, in this moment, this is Paul's way of referring to the message of the gospel. He's talking about the words which carry the message of life. And so he's saying that we need both. We need the word. We actually need the message of the gospel and the proof of what it does in us, which is our lives and our behavior. So when the message about this humble King Jesus who gave up his life comes out of our mouths as we hold up the word of life, and our relationships with one another demonstrate that same humility that Jesus had, that is profound and powerful. And what Paul is saying is that that's pure and blameless. That is integrity. That is wholeness. That is the goal for us. Okay, that's the main gist, verses 14 through 16. We're going to come back to that in a minute, but let's talk through the rest of these verses quickly. Verses 16 through the rest of 16 through 18. After we shine like stars in the sky, Paul says, and then I will be able to boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor in vain. But even if I am being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service coming from your faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you. So you too should be glad and rejoice with me. Paul looks forward to the day of Christ. It says his way of talking about this future reality, the future new heaven and new earth when Jesus returns and establishes his kingdom fully and completely. And what Paul is saying is that that day will hold the proof that his work and his ministry in the lives of this church was actually effective. Spiritual formation, becoming like Jesus, is incredibly slow. Can I get an amen? It takes a very long time. We feel that. Paul knew that. And he was fixed on this future prize of seeing these people fully complete in Christ, seeing them as they are intended to be and how Jesus will fully form them into his image. It's like he's working on this sculpture. Right now, at times, it just feels like it's mostly a square slab of stone. But he knows that someday that's going to look like Michelangelo's David sculpture. And so he's looking forward to that day when he sees these people that he has contended for and fought for and ministered to as the finished product. And he'll have the satisfaction of knowing every stroke of the hammer and the chisel on this project of who they are. Even when it seemed like it wasn't working, even when it seemed like it was slow, it was totally working to create them and us into the image of Jesus. And for that prize in his mind, he is willing to sacrifice his life and his well-being and to be spent and poured out. And he rejoices in that and wants us to as well. We're going to take a quick pause, a little short breather. I have to tell you something. If the Dumb and Dumber fiasco of 2026 wasn't enough, I will never forget it. Something else that I'm not proud of. Sometimes I have a really hard time. Sometimes I have a really hard time staying focused when someone is talking to me and giving me more detail than I think I need about that thing. Maybe that's how you feel right now in this moment as I'm talking to you. I want a shortcut to the info that I really need. This happens the most in conversations with my wife. I have her permission to tell this story, just so you know. It happens when she is telling me about a conversation that she has had with someone. And what she wants to do, what she does, is she gives me the transcript, like the whole conversation, and she's got the quotes, and she's like, here's what I said, and she says exactly what she said, exactly how she said it. And then she does both voices of like both parties. She like does the other person's voice, and she reads everything that they've said too. She's giving the whole transcript, the exact quotes. She's very good at it. But what I was hoping for was the AI summary and just like action items that pertain to me only. That's just not how it works. And my wife can see it in my eyes when I start to lose steam and I can't hide it. And I'm really not proud of it and I am working on it. Verses 19 through 30 seem like the type of detail that I would become impatient about. And there's tons of this throughout Paul's letters in the New Testament where he's talking about like travel plans and like itinerary and arrangements. He's like, I'm sending this guy to you and because you guys sent this guy to me and you guys sent this gift over here and we're doing this. And he's telling you about the inner workings of all these people and things. And you're like, can't you just tell me what you told me in verses 14? Just like, don't complain. And then we just like be done reading the Bible. And he's like, no, we have more detail to give you. We have to remember that the people Paul is about to talk about in these verses, he's going to bring up a few people. They were not random names that they had to like look up context for, like, who is this person? We don't know who it is. They knew who these people were. They were beloved people that this church knew about, and Paul is bringing them up for a particular reason. So all that to say, don't pull a Michael and lose steam before we finish the passage here. We've got 11 more verses. Let's look at 19 through 24. Paul says, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I also may be cheered when I receive news about you. I have no one else like him who will show genuine concern for your welfare. For everyone looks out for their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know that Timothy has proved himself because, as a son with his father, he has served with me in the work of the gospel. I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things go with me, and I'm confident in the Lord that I myself will come soon. Timothy was Paul's go-to guy. They did ministry together. They started churches together. Paul would go on to send Timothy to Ephesus as like this resident pastor, church planter for a while. Timothy was likely with Paul at some point in this journey of starting this church here in Philippi, so they probably knew him. In these verses, Paul is saying that Timothy had already proved himself, that he was like Christ in his behavior, namely that he didn't look out for his own interests only, but was a great example of a dedicated servant that serves Jesus in his work for the gospel. So Paul is just giving detail and like, hey, remember Timothy? Cool guy, right? He is highlighting a particular example of a shining star in a crooked generation. And his name is Timothy. But there was another one that he wanted to help them notice, and his name was Epaphroditus. Verse 25 through 30. I think it is necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus, my brother, co-worker, and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs. For he longs for all of you and is distressed because you heard he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, to spare me sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again, you may be glad and I may have less anxiety. So then, welcome him in the Lord with great joy and honor people like him because he almost died for the work of Christ. He risked his life to make up for the help you yourselves could not give me. The backstory is that sometime after Paul had helped start this church in Philippi, they sent one of their own, Epaphroditus. If you're looking for baby names, I dare you. And you could call him Didus for short, and people would be like, Titus? I'd be like, no, Didus with a D. They send Epaphroditus to bring a financial gift and a report from the church to Paul about how they were doing. And then Paul goes on to, like, this is Paul, like, high praise for Paul here, singing the praises of this guy, calls him a co-worker and a fellow soldier. That is Paul's way of saying, like, we're basically on the same level of dedication to Jesus and to the gospel. Somewhere in the course of this journey, Epaphroditus got really sick and nearly died. Everyone was very worried. And so Paul is excited, one, that he didn't die, two, that he gets to send back to them this selfless example who risked his life to serve Jesus. He tells them to honor him and others like him who risked their lives, whether due to some type of danger or illness, in the course of serving Jesus. All right, we made it through our 17 verses. Well done. Before we get back to kind of the heart of verses 14 through 16, I want to give just a quick little challenge or encouragement based on something we just read, and then a short one-slide summary of chapter 2, because we just finished chapter 2. So the encouragement is this. Straight from the words of Paul himself, he says, honor people like Epaphroditus and others who put themselves at risk in the course of serving Jesus. So would you just receive that as directly to you right now, that you would honor people who risk themselves in some way serving Jesus. This definitely obviously applies to those who are literally bringing the message of Jesus to places in the world that are hostile to Christianity. So I just want to bring to your attention some friends of Valley who are doing this now or have done this recently and or have made it their life work to help people do this. So the first one I want to tell you about is a friend of mine named Reed Saunders. He's an evangelist, and he is overseas, like, all the time sharing the gospel with people. Reed was my discipleship leader in middle school. He was on Valley Church's advisory board when we started, and he is this example. He has given his life to the cause of telling people about Jesus, often in places that maybe put him at risk a little bit. And so I just want to honor Reed Saunders in front of our church family, that he not only has he supported our church in helping us start this thing, but he's a minister of the gospel who has given his life to that. I also want to point out the Steele family. Tim and Cassie, you guys are in here. You guys recently have gone overseas to tell people about Jesus. And also, I've made it your life's work to equip and send missionaries all over the world with what you do at YWAM. So we just want to say thank you. We honor you for doing that. And he's not here right now, but our friend Tucker Henderson is in Cambodia right now. He's a missionary with YWAM. And so we just, he can't hear us, but Tucker, we honor you too and are proud of you. Maybe he'll listen to the podcast. I don't know. On a different scale, I think we can also honor those who spend themselves, their life energy in service of you, helping you follow Jesus. I think this is partially why Paul brought up Timothy and Epaphroditus. They were examples of a life dedicated to the gospel and to serving, just like Jesus. So not only are we encouraged to be like them, to do as they did, but to honor those who did or who do. And so I just want you to take a few seconds and think about someone, maybe in this church, maybe someone else from another season of your life who has spent themselves for you. Time and energy given to help you follow Jesus. And just in this moment in your heart, would you just give them honor for that? Maybe pray for them. And if you can, send them a text or give them a call or write them a card if that option is available to you, and just do something to obey the apostle's command here to honor those who have served you and the church in that way. All right, here's the summary. We just finished reading chapter 2. Well done. The main thing is that we're reading here is that to follow Jesus is to be others-centered, not self-centered. That's the gist of verses 1 through 11. And then we kind of get the picture that being others-centered should be visible. We should be able to see it. If I have a view of your life, I should be able to tell by looking at the way you live that you are living other-centered. It should be clearly visible, particularly in our relationships with one another here in the church. And then finally, 19 through 30, we just have two amazing examples of this, Timothy and Epaphroditus. We asked a question at the beginning. In what particular way should our lives as Jesus followers look different in a world that feels warped and crooked? And the answer is simple. Like I said, we read it right off the bat in verses 14 and 15. Our lives should look different in the way we relate to one another. It should be visible in our friendships and relationship in the church, specifically by living in humility and relational harmony. And that sounds wonderful, right? You're like, yeah, sign me up for that. A humble community who isn't marked by arguing, fighting, or complaining. It sounds great, but it is so much easier said than done. And maybe in some ways or in some seasons of your life, it can feel like the church is like not much better than the world, maybe even worse at times. And so I want to wrap up by thinking through a few questions. One, why is this so difficult for us to live this out and to embody this? Two, does the gospel actually have a better answer than the world? What about the message of Jesus is compelling us to live this way? And three, in what areas of my life should I be focusing and how can I live this out? So the first question was, why is this so difficult for us to live out? I think there are at least two reasons. The first is that we have bad models for peace and relational harmony, bad like ideas, structures of how we create peace and harmony in our life. I've heard these bad models called the warrior, the ostrich, and the hippie. Warriors make peace and harmony by winning, by just being better and stronger at arguing and fighting with people. Ostriches make peace by burying their head in the sand, ignoring the conflicts around them, keeping themselves out of the spaces that make for conflict. Hippies, maybe, I don't know, stereotypically, make peace with passivity or some kind of like surface level fake kindness. Like, it's all good. Like, we just don't have to fight about it. But that can't hold up to the real world, to the actual real wounds that we receive and give in relationship with one another. So those false models are very easy for us to default to when we're trying to either fix some relational difficulty or trying to avoid it altogether, but they are shortcuts. And they bypass the type of relationship, wounding, healing, reconciliation that Paul and Jesus intend for us to work through together as a church family. So that's one of the reasons why it's hard. You have these bad ideas of how it looks. And the second reason is that we have these really, really strong impulses, like these internal drivers that make us naturally defensive and contentious. So we get reactive in situations in our relationships when I think these one of three desires get threatened or tested. And those are the need to be understood and known, the need for others to know, like deep down, really, I'm a good person, and the need for people to know that I'm not an idiot. I actually understand things. In my experience, arguments get heated, and maybe if they don't kind of blow up when you're talking with someone, but you're heated when you leave the argument and you go back to your own world, they get heated because someone tested one of those things. Someone made you, you made me feel misunderstood. You made me feel like you don't think that I'm a good person who cares about people. You made me feel foolish, or you made me feel like I don't know a buttload of crap about the gospel. I gotta stop trying to tell jokes. When those things are tested, we get defensive and sharp, and we might retreat or withdraw. We might cut ties with someone, or we might go inward and we kind of craft and rehearse our defense, like maybe you're in the shower or falling asleep at night or something. You replay conversations in your head, daydream, like, oh, if I had a chance to settle that conversation again, here's what I would say. And so we lose sight of this goal of meaningful resolution and peace and harmony because we just want vindication. It's why this call to live out a Christ-centered, humble, non-argumentative way of life is so hard, because Paul is putting his finger on a very, very sensitive nerve. He is touching a part of our hearts that are trying to secure ourselves in the world. And that is why precisely the gospel has a much better answer than the world has to offer. So the world's answer is getting us the results that we are living in right now. And if the world invites you to join the fight, pick a side and just win, have a better argument, or try to ride the fence, try not to make anyone mad, or just pull back and don't talk about risky things and protect yourselves. None of those options can answer the deep longings that you have to be actually fully known and accepted and loved, which is why the gospel is so compelling, because in Jesus, my friends at Valley Church, you are already totally secure. You don't have to prove to anyone, to me, to one another, that you are righteous, smart, good, impressive, because Jesus has already confirmed your worth and value to him for sure, and he has confirmed your worth, your value, and your place within the family of God right here in our church. You matter already. You don't have to prove it. You don't have to secure yourself at someone else's expense. You don't have to win arguments or interactions because Jesus knows your heart. You don't have to ensure that you are understood because Jesus understands you, maybe even better than you understand yourself. And so when your desire to be seen as good or righteous or as a caring person is threatened, we don't have to unravel or crumble because our own righteousness was never enough in the first place. This is the gospel that Jesus gave us, his righteousness, and took our sin. You guys have heard the term justification. It's the word we use to talk about being made right in our relationship with God. And if you've heard that word, you've probably heard it described as how it's like we've never done anything wrong, that's kind of the nature of being justified before God. And that is half of it. The other half is that it is as though you had always done the right thing. That's what justification is that you have Jesus's record. And so when God looks at you, when we look at each other, that's what we are supposed to see. If you have not heard that before, if you're hearing it afresh right now, stop listening to me and start talking to the Lord and say, I need that. Remind me of that. Give that to me. I want to be forgiven. And so when someone touches that nerve and it feels like they're effectively saying, you're broken, you don't understand, you don't have it, we can actually, as the people of God, go, you are right. The gospel already told me that. And Jesus's love and his kindness met me there in my lack of understanding, in my lack of goodness. Jesus met me there, and now I'm just trying to live out my life and honor Jesus as the best I can. This allows us to lay down our weapons, to put on the humility of Jesus, and pursue actual, real peace in our relationships with each other. We don't have to avoid the hard things, but we can approach them with selflessness and without defensiveness. So we're gonna close. I'm gonna bring up four areas of your life, and my guess is that one of them will be like, ding, 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 that's the area that I gotta really like think about how this applies. So the first one is the home. I'm not sure why it is this way, but the people closest to us are sometimes the easiest people to be mean to. So would you just ask yourself right now, what spirit or vibe do you bring into your home, into your marriage, into your parenting, your relationships with your kids, your parents, siblings, other family relationships? Do you easily complain? Do you grumble constantly in the home? Do you keep a record of wrongs? Do you create or contribute to a tense or heated environment in your home because you're living in a culture of contentiousness? My intention isn't to heap guilt in this moment, but just to invite you to approach the Lord in humility and go, yes, that's me and I need help. What would it be like if the Lord did a work in you and in your home, softened your heart, created a spirit and an environment of peace and harmony? It would be beautiful, and he can do it. He can do it. So maybe that's the one where you're like, I need that. And you could just have a moment with the Lord right now. I'm gonna keep talking, but you can do some business with the Lord and invite him to start doing that work in you. What about when it comes to your presence in our local community, like whether that's your job or schools, groups, teams, associations, I don't know, things that you're involved with, real people here in our area. At this point, would you say that you are shining like a star in a warped and crooked generation? How do you handle frustration and misunderstanding, criticism towards yourself? How do you handle the flaws of other people when they affect you? Are you the kind of person who escalates tension, or can you bring peace, the peace and wisdom of God, to those around you? Do you contribute to a culture of complaining? Do people around you experience you as defensive or easily offended, or as secure and humble? We have to be different from the world in this way, not to make ourselves seem better or superior, but because the world is desperate for another way, desperate for an escape from the insanity and self-defeating nature of sin and selfishness. It does not create life. It does not create flourishing. People are exhausted and angry and unhappy and lonely, and we have an opportunity to show them what Jesus can do, and it has to start in you and in me. How about your engagement with culture, politics, social media? This is probably not like an issue, but we'll talk about it just in case. The church, our church, will not shine by being louder or more angry than the rest of the world. We will fail to bear witness to the goodness of Jesus if we allow ourselves to become just as reactive, just as cynical, and just as tribal. And when we act that way and attach Bible verses to it, we do significant damage. We are supposed to, allowed to, care deeply about the truth, but what is almost as important, maybe equally important, is our demeanor and spirit. It has to match the humility of the Lord Jesus when we approach those areas of life. We can be convicted without becoming contentious, and we can disagree without being divisive. Last area is the church. If there was one arena where Paul really expected this message to land, it is in the church, in our relationships with one another. I happen to think that Valley Church has embodied this pretty well. And so I just wanna say thank you. If you've had to give me grace, or if you've had to give one another grace, this is an area that I feel proud of the way that our church has done relationships with one another. But Jesus told us how important this is when he told the disciples that the world will know we're his disciples by our love for one another. So it's not just about like, maybe we've done a good job of like sidestepping and avoiding the issues that could like cause dissension amongst us. But what's being described is a culture of like genuine love, harmony and peace in spite of the things that we disagree about. And so if you're willing, when you think about your place here in Valley Church, would you just ask yourself, are you contributing to a culture of unity, honoring one another, being quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, quick to forgive, ready to assume the best in others, approaching one another with patient love rather than reactive resentment or criticism? If we embody that, as we embody that, I genuinely believe that will be one of the most powerful things that our community could see, is if we embody this and live this out.